Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are really going a step beyond the usual management advice. We're diving into what's maybe the deepest well of organizational behavior, which is, you know, the human psyche itself.
Right.
So this deep dive, it's really for you, the curious leader, the one who gets that real change, isn't just about, I don't know, new software or another reorg.
It's about what happens on the inside. It's about cultivating a genuinely productive, mature, and, well, collaborative environment from the inside out.
Exactly.
And I think our mission today, looking at these sources, which are this amazing blend of organizational theory and psychology, is to really uncover what keeps organizations stuck.
The root causes.
The root causes, yeah. We want to understand the psychological barriers that stop individuals and whole groups from really growing up.
And then what?
And then we'll get practical. We'll explore the specific methods leaders can actually use, everything from, you know, the art of deep listening to rapid prototyping.
All aiming for what our sources are calling a state of optimal balance.
Right. Optimal balance.
Which is such a challenge because at our core, we're all sort of walking contradictions, aren't we?
We are. The sources point to two fundamental dilemmas. These are things that define the human condition. And, well, they follow us into every single meeting room.
Okay, where are they?
First, there's the tension between the individual and the community.
Me versus us.
Right. And second, the conflict between stability and change.
So staying the same versus moving forward.
Exactly. And these tensions are constant. They create this kind of low-level hum of ambivalence in us all the time.
That's a great way to put it. Ambivalence, the discomfort of holding two opposing truths at once.
And the psyche just can't tolerate that forever. It can't stay paralyzed. So it sets up all these different defense mechanisms to, well, to simplify reality.
So how we handle that ambivalence is really what determines how effective we are.
That's it. That's the whole game. And it defines what we can think of as three levels of psychological maturity.
Which we can use as a kind of roadmap.
A roadmap, yeah. For both personal insight and for, you know, getting a team to collaborate successfully. It's splitting, suppression, and then finally integration.
Okay, so let's start at the bottom. The foundational, least mature level.
Yes.
Splitting.
Right.
Now, this isn't just about being, you know, argumentative in a meeting. It's something much deeper, a kind of existential simplification. So how does splitting show up in a group?
Well, you said it. It's the ultimate defense mechanism because it lets a person avoid all that messy complexity.
Yeah, it just cuts right through it.
Completely. You divide the world, you divide yourself into these really clean binary categories.
Good and bad. Black and white.
Right versus wrong. All the shades of gray, the actual reality of the situation, they're just eliminated.
And when a whole group is stuck there, operating in that splitting mode, what happens to the individual? It seems like their identity just kind of dissolves, right?
It does. It's sacrificed. You give up your individual identity in exchange for this fixed, safe identity inside the group. The focus is all external.
And the leader.
The leader becomes a screen for projection. The group either projects all good qualities onto them, idealizes them, they can do no wrong. Or when things go south,
they become the source of all evil.
Yeah.
Demonized.
Exactly. Yeah. So that environment is all high drama, but very low productivity. There's no stable, nuanced foundation to build on.
Yeah, that sounds completely unsustainable. Okay, so moving up the ladder, we get to the second level, which feels more common in, say, corporate life, suppression.
Or what the Danish sources call fortraining.
It feels like a step towards order, but it's still fundamentally blocking the truth, isn't it?
It's a step up for sure, because it at least acknowledges that conflicts exist, but the goal is to control them, to minimize that ambivalence by just locking it down through fixed systems, rigid routines, strict hierarchy. It's basically governance through extreme bureaucracy.
So that need for control becomes the absolute central principle.
It does.
This sounds incredibly familiar, especially when people face huge life transitions like retirement. Let's talk about that case of Søren the pensioner.
Søren is a perfect example. Here's a guy who'd been at the same organization for decades. He's facing this immense ambivalence about retiring.
Consciously, he's probably feeling proud, happy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Joy, pride. But unconsciously, there's this profound anxiety about leaving his community, about the massive change to his sense of stability.
And he suppresses those negative feelings.
He does. He displaces all that energy into control. His defense mechanism shows up as this intense professional pride, where he creates this ridiculously detailed manual for his job and insists on personally naming his successor.
He's using that manual, that whole ritual, as a kind of psychological shield.
It's a perfect shield against the anxiety. It was a perfect system, and it had to stay perfect for his ego to survive this transition. But then
reality hits.
His colleagues, you know, trying to be efficient, they propose simplifying his tasks and spreading them out.
Oh, no.
Which basically challenged the necessity of his masterpiece, his manual. And in that moment, Surin's whole defense mechanism just, it shattered.
Because it was never about the job tasks. It was about the threat to his self-worth, his fear of becoming obsolete.
Precisely. And because he couldn't consciously acknowledge that sudden flood of anxiety and ambivalence, he displaces it. It comes out as this unacknowledged rage at the perceived disrespect. He ends up taking sick leave.
Wow. And the defense, while it protected him for a bit, it just prevented any real productive conversation from happening.
That's it. And you can see how that plays out on a bigger scale. The organizational cost of a suppressive culture is just, it's massive.
Initiative gets crushed. Creativity is blocked by endless routines.
And the conflicts don't vanish. They just go underground. They manifest indirectly.
Right. So you see things like endless, pointless reorganizations where everyone blaming the system instead of the actual tension between people, or those awful long meetings where nothing gets decided.
Those are the symptoms. And the only way forward is integration. But, and this is the hard part, to get there, you have to be willing to enter a transitional state of confusion.
The messy middle.
What one source calls the jammer zone.
The jammer zone. I like that.
Excellent.
It sounds like where all the real work happens.
It is. It's the necessary mess that happens when you stop suppressing conflict and you actually let it surface. Integration is what happens when you navigate that mess successfully.
And paradoxically, an integrated group actually has more conflict, not less.
Yes. Because the emotional contact within the group is stronger, it's healthier, it's robust enough to handle the tension.
So integration is really just about expanding our tolerance for complexity, for holding two ideas at once. Can you give us a practical example of what that looks like?
Sure. It means tolerating ambivalence without acting out. So an integrated project manager who has bad news doesn't delay or sugarcoat it.
They just deliver it.
They present the full picture, trusting that the team can handle the complexity. They can say something like, the Danish welfare state is excellent at providing X service, but it also has serious weaknesses in Y area.
And they can hold both those truths at the same time to find a better solution.
Right. You see yourself as both a unique individual and as a valuable member of the community. That dual perspective, that's the key to higher performance.
Okay, so if integration is the psychological goal for the people, for the team, what's the organizational equivalent? What kind of structure do you need to harness all that capacity?
Right, because an integrated team needs a framework that isn't too stifling, but also isn't just complete chaos.
Yeah, you need to avoid those two traps, being too rigid, too bureaucratic, or on the other hand, being too chaotic and unfocused.
And our sources give us this great concept that just captures this perfectly. Flexibilitet.
Flexibilitet. It's a great word. Flexibility plus stability.
Exactly.
It sounds like an ideal, but how is it any different from just, you know, a 50-50 compromise?
That's the crucial question. Because the mistake most leaders make is they treat flexibility and stability as if they're on opposite ends of one long spectrum.
So more of one means less of the other.
Right. And if you think that way, the best you can ever get is a mediocre compromise, 50% of each. Flexibilitet demands that you see them as two separate dimensions, both of which you can maximize.
You're saying you can have high performance in both at the same time.
Absolutely. The state of flexibilitet is superior because you're achieving high flexibility. So lots of space for creativity, for change, for freedom. And you have high stability, a fixed, secure foundation, a strong sense of focus.
It's the both-and state.
It's the optimal both-and state. The stability actually becomes the secure base that enables the flexibility.
Okay, but isn't that inherently impossible? Especially when you're under real pressure, you know, budget cuts, market demands. Doesn't that ideal just collapse?
It feels impossible because our typical linear way of thinking isn't designed to hold that kind of tension. Flexibilitet isn't a fixed state, it's a dynamic zone you operate in.
Okay, connect that to complexity theory for us.
Well, the sweet spot is what's sometimes called the emergence zone, or the chaotic field, that intersection of chaos and order.
I see.
When you maximize both of those dimensions, stability and flexibility, you're operating right where new order can spontaneously emerge from these dynamic, nonlinear systems.
This requires a totally different kind of leadership, a different way of seeing the world.
It does. Which is why frameworks like Cinefin are so helpful. A leader has to know if their problem is simple Meaning there's a known solution.
Or complicated, where you need experts and analysis.
Right. Or if it's truly complex, where cause and effect are only clear in hindsight.
Yeah.
If you apply a complicated process, like a 5-year rigid plan, to a complex problem, like a massive market shift,
you're going to fail.
You're going to fail.
Right.
That optimal state of flow stabilitet exists precisely in that complex zone, ready for emergence, where you have to prioritize intuition and agility over just categorization.
So if psychological integration and organizational flexibilitet are the destinations, mm-hmm. what's the vehicle that gets us there?
The how.
Yeah. How does a leader actually guide a team toward this? The sources really emphasize that success depends on the leader addressing their own blind spot, the inner place from which they operate.
That's correct. Leaders are usually pretty aware of what they do and how they do it. But that inner source, the who they are as they're doing it, that is often invisible to them.
And that's where something like Theory U comes in.
Exactly. Theory U identifies 4 different levels of attention, of listening, that really dictate the quality of our results. The job of the leader is to intentionally shift their team and themselves from a reactive state to a genuinely generative one.
Let's walk through those. The first 2 levels feel pretty normal, right?
They are. Level 1 is downloading. You're just reinforcing what you already believe.
I knew that.
I already know that, and this conversation is just confirming it for me. Then level 2 is factual. You're listening for new data, things that might contradict what you know.
Oh, look at there.
Right. And both are necessary for science, for survival. But they only reflect the past or the present.
The big shift happens when you go deeper.
Into the deeper levels of connection. Level 3 is empathic listening. You're really trying to see the situation through the other person's eyes and their heart. It requires an open heart.
You get a real emotional connection.
Yes. But the highest and the hardest level is 4, generative or creative listening. And this demands an open will.
An open will? What does that actually unlock?
It's the capacity to connect not to what is or what was, but to the future possibilities that are trying to emerge through the system, through the conversation.
So when you listen that way,
you are transformed by the act of listening. You are not the same person at the end of the conversation because you've connected to this deeper sense of self and possibility. You've co-created something new that didn't exist before.
You know, we see this in peak performance, like in sports. That Bill Russell quote about zone spill seems like a perfect description of this state.
It's the perfect analogy for operating from that level 4 state, what we call presencing. Russell described games where everything became magical, time slowed down.
He could anticipate the next play.
Intuitively. He was operating out of a connection to the larger whole. He said he wasn't just playing his individual part, his micro violin. He was playing the macro violin, the entire cathedral.
Wow.
That ability to act from the emerging whole, that is the essence of generative leadership.
That makes perfect sense. So that internal shift enables you to sense the future.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't just sense, you have to act. Which is why the U process moves right into action.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, this idea of prototyping from design thinking.
Right, because analysis paralysis is the enemy of innovation.
Mm.
We're so often trained to analyze, then finalize a plan, get it approved, and then build the perfect thing. Prototyping flips that entirely. It brings the head, the heart, and the hand together. It's part of the sensing and discovery process itself.
You build something simple just to see how people react.
Yeah.
Then you adapt and repeat.
Exactly.
And for those huge, messy, ill-defined problems like social change or these big organizational transformations, the sources have this great idea. The Trojan mouse strategy.
I love that term.
Me too.
A Trojan mouse is small, it's lean, it's quick. Its job isn't to win the war on day one.
Its job is to test the waters.
Test the waters and inform your next move. This strategy, by its nature, lets an organization pivot really fast and learn from failures without massive sunk costs.
But how do you get a highly suppressive control freak organization to embrace that? To embrace a Trojan mouse that's basically designed to fail and iterate? You're essentially asking them to invite the jammer zone right into their workflow.
That is exactly what generative leadership does. It introduces productive confusion, but within a stable frame. That's flexibility in action.
So you sell it as learning.
You sell it as rapid, low-cost learning. Look at the Kairos Fellowship, which trains leaders of color in digital organizing. It started as a tiny experiment, a Trojan mouse. It was just testing its ideas.
It was small.
Because it was small, when the urgency of the movement for Black lives exploded, they were ready. They could adapt their whole model almost overnight, pouring resources into what was working and just dropping what wasn't. They learn their way to success because they weren't trapped by some huge, rigid, 5-year plan. So if we bring this all together, the core idea is really synergistic. To get to that highly productive organizational state, to flex stability.
That combination of high stability and high flexibility.
You first have to cultivate high psychological maturity, that state of integration, both in individuals and in the group as a whole.
And that psychological shift.
Yeah.
It's powered by these generative methods, the deep listening, the presencing, the rapid prototyping. They force you into this intentional mode of discovery and action.
Right. And whether you call it design thinking's double diamond, you know, divergence, opening up the problem.
Then going through the confusion of the jammer zone.
And then into convergence on a new solution. Or whether you call it the theory U journey, the process is the same.
Hmm.
It demands that leaders deliberately expose themselves and their teams to complexity, not shield them from it.
And that exposure is what lets you create new stories, new narratives about what's possible.
Which brings us back to a core idea from constructionist thought, which is simply, the world is as I see it.
Mm.
Our identity, our organization's reality. It's all continuously created through the stories we tell about ourselves and our relationships.
So that leaves us with one final provocative question for you to think about.
What new narrative will you start constructing today to guide yourself and your organization toward that integrated state of flexibility?